Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 14 of What's It Like? My guest is Ed Goldfarb, composer, arranger, pianist. Anything else I should add to that list?
Yeah, composer, keyboard player, producer, arranger, audio engineer, educator.
Well, that's a pretty good list.
The things we do to stay alive in this business.
There you go. I was talking to Mike Vaccaro the other day, who is one of the world's best woodwind players.
Oh.
He says he wishes that he had taken piano as a child, because to be an arranger or a composer, you really need to have a piano background. Does that sound true to you?
It's certainly useful. The thing that the piano does for you is that it kind of gives you everything at your fingertips. As you learn to play piano, you get used to handling multiple streams of musical information simultaneously. And I think that that's a useful skill if you're going to be arranging.
Mm-hmm.
Musical arranging is just figuring out what everybody in an ensemble is going to be doing at the same time. So you need to be able to hear that in your head. And I know I work kind of really tactilely. Like it'll be easier for me to come up with a four-part vocal arrangement sitting at the keyboard and letting my fingers do the talking than it will be to think it through in my head. And, you know, as a kid, you're a sponge. And if you get started on the piano, you know, and I remember what a challenge it was to play two different lines, one in each hand. And once you kind of get your head working that way, it becomes easier and easier. And you also read music when you're playing piano. If you're taught to play piano, you're taught to read music. And you're taught to read more than one line at once, because the piano does a bunch of things. And it kind of doesn't matter how great a woodwind player or to a lesser extent a string player, because they're capable of doing more than one note at once. But the other instruments, basically, you're always playing one note at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And you can become great at that, but working with sheet music as a pianist is an entirely different deal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's useful.
I was classically trained as a tenor.
Oh, right on.
And so I think in my head in terms of those kinds of notes.
Mm-hmm.
But arrangers that I know think in orchestra.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You start to, you know, someone will hum a line and you're like, oh, that's clarinet or whatever. You just naturally start to think that way. And it's cool. You know, you might drive into a tree sometime because your mind isn't where it should be, but than that.
Did you always want to be a musician?
I kind of didn't have a choice, which I get. So I guess that means that the answer is yes. I was not an early, like, 3-year-old crazy child prodigy. And when I started taking music lessons at 6 years old. And it took me a little while to figure it out, but by the end, by the time I got out of my Yamaha music training group class, which is sort of the equivalent of what they do with Suzuki classes today, by the time I got out of it, I was sort of directing the other kids and doing little things where I would say, okay, you play tambourine now, and that kind of thing. my dad worked his way through Harvard Law School playing in Dixieland bands, and he always had kind of music playing. And my mom loved playing Beatles songs on the piano and stuff, and those records were hanging out. I think Revolver came out like a month before I did.
Mm-hmm.
And Revolver and Sgt. Pepper and the early Sesame Street records and stuff like that. I remember those playing at the house constantly, Bach, Brandenburg concertos, that kind of thing, and just kind of sunk in.
They had quite a range of musical backgrounds.
Yeah. I mean, my dad was not a contemporary pop music fan, and so we didn't. That mostly came from my mom. And I grew up in the great, what we now recognize as one of the great eras of radio, the late 60s and 70s, you know, where Top 40 would cover a little bit of everything, folk music, R&B, disco. When that happened, hard rock, you would hear a little bit of everything. So I got my brother and I, who's also a musician, we refer to back of mom's car music. Stuff. A lot of other musicians I know who came up around the same time have a similar kind of affinity for that stuff. So music was all around, with markedly less distractions than you have nowadays, although there's something to be said for distractions too.
or opportunities.
Right. That's an old Chinese proverb, isn't it? Distraction equals opportunity. I might have one of those wrong. Is it crisis equals opportunity?
Close enough.
Yeah.
What was your major challenge in school?
Probably as a kid, my major challenge was just kind of not fitting in with other kids, not enjoying kid pursuits, and not feeling not feeling out of place because of the music thing, and just because I was kind of a geek, that back then we didn't know that the geek would inherit the earth. Although, as we got older, certainly the writing was on the wall. And musicians, are usually geeks, but they also, they kind of jump between social strata and school, or at least I did, because, I was involved in theater because I could play piano. And, once teachers got wind of what I could do, I was always being drafted to be in different kind of productions, play piano so that the choir teachers didn't have to. By the time I was 10, I was pretty good. So I was, I wrote my first arrangement actually when I was in junior high school, because there was a song that the director wanted to add to the musical. I think I was in seventh grade, and I overheard them looking around to get a chart for it, to rent it from some library or something like that. And me being me, I said, I could do it. And I did. They ended up using it. And I think that might have been my first professional gig. I know my first gig was, I played my first party for a friend's dad's 40th anniversary, 40th birthday. And I know I got paid for that, but I think I got paid for the chart too. I don't remember which came first. Someone had to, they had to recopy it. One of the teachers had to recopy it and distribute the parts because the handwriting, was ridiculous.
Before computers.
Yeah. But there you go. Yeah, my hand did not look as good at 13 as Mozart's did at 6, but,
few people's do.
Yeah, and he didn't have Laverne and Shirley to distract him. So.
That's true. When you write now, do you do it by hand or you do it by computer?
I do it on the computer simply because it's so much quicker. If I have to write it by hand, I will. If I'm just in a situation. And my hand ended up getting pretty good in college because we didn't have computers ready to go yet for that. I think I got my first copy of Finale like the year after I got out of college, and even then it was such a hopeless buggy program. It took him a good 10 years to shake all that stuff out, although now the manuscript programs are wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go to college?
I went to Cal Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I got a degree in music. I got into other schools, and I really wanted it's at that age I can't remember whether I wanted it or whether my parents wanted it, when you're a kid, what's the difference, right? I guess I wanted a general education, and Berkeley seemed the best bet. If I'd gone to Stanford, I'd still be paying it off, Harvard the same thing. So, and Berkeley was a great school, and it was inexpensive. It was close to home, but not so close to home that it was like living at home. And it worked out great. They don't differentiate in their music major. You can't say, oh, I was a composition major or I was a conducting major. It's like I was a music major. But I basically focused on conducting a little bit, composition rather. I didn't take conducting because it was at 8 a.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I continue with piano performance and stuff. But when people ask, I say that I majored in Led Zeppelin and minored in marijuana, and that is as accurate as anything else.
What did you do after college?
After college, by this time, I was a pretty busy professional musician. My father worked for IBM for years, for like 30 years or something. The last generation to have one of those sort of cradle to grave jobs, I think, and. I kind of was raised with that mentality that even though I was a musician, which my parents really supported, even though I was a musician, I should look for steady gigs, try to find something that resembles traditional employment because that's what had worked for the family I grew up in. So when I was a senior in high school, I auditioned for church gigs as an organist. I joined the American Guild of Organists and started reading the want ads and just auditioned. And no one ever said, "What are you kidding? You're 17 years old." You know, one group before they met with me asked for me to send a cassette, and then you know they're like, "Fine." And I remember the Christian Scientists rejecting me because I added a few notes to the hymns, and they're like, "Don't do that," especially with Mary Baker Eddy's hymns. We play them straight. But when I auditioned at a Methodist church, they were really excited by what I did, and I didn't know a lot about comparative religion, I later learned about the Methodists, just their natural and inclusive nature and how it says much about getting together and creating an extended family than it is about, any particular doctrine. So it was a good fit. It ended up being really great. I started as a substitute organist and commuted down from Berkeley. It was about 45 minutes away. And from there, I went to full-time organist. And by the time that I was out of college at 22, they had made me choir director, music director. And I stayed with that job after I got married. So I was with them for 17 years.
That's a long gig.
It was a long gig, but it was great. You know, as a kid, it was really great to be able to make money making music. And the nature of church music is that the church has sort of acted as the patron for composers since there was such a thing. You know, Bach wrote all of his great cantatas because he was doing what I did. He was a music director at a church. So I got started writing large-scale works, and I got some education in teaching singers and leading groups and arranging for ensembles. And so by the time I auditioned for the San Francisco Musical Review Beach Blanket Babylon when I was 24, I had quite a bit of experience for somebody that age. I got out of school and I immediately had practical knowledge.
I gather you weren't raised Methodist?
I was not raised Methodist. I'm Jewish. But, you know, everybody's really saying the same thing, you know. And that's the way I looked at it anyway. I mean, the anthems that I wrote for the church, I did and still do, you know, use the language of that, of the church, as as other great Jewish composers, you know, Leonard Bernstein, Mendelssohn, you know, there's precedent for that. Mm-hmm. The group that you're writing for, you use the appropriate language, and it's just been a real multifaceted education, and that's just a tiny facet of what I've done professionally.
So when you write for them, do you write something they would interpret within their framework, but not necessarily what you believe?
Well, like I said, we can't believe the same thing. You know, I mean, Jews aren't a proselytizing faith, and there's one God, not three, and you don't put a face on him, etc.
Well, there's something about dying and rising again that's probably not in Orthodox Judaism.
No. Or even in Reform Judaism, although the Orthodox have a different name for Reform Jews, they call them Christians. I think there's a place in the world for all kinds of beliefs and walks of life, but Orthodox is not how I roll. It's hard on the chicks. It's tough on the women. It seems kind of retrograde isn't the word, but it seems a little behind the times where that stuff's concerned. And plus, life without pork, it's hard to imagine.
Do you write something about Jesus and Christ, or do you do it more globally?
No. I mean, I write about Jesus. It's hard to get past him, and it really is such an awesome story that having some stuff for Easter this year, and the thing that really strikes me about it is the cyclical nature. As I get into real middle age and not early middle age, it it's increasingly interesting to me just how, to quote the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, among numerous other sources, everything that's happened will happen again. And, you know, it's the eternal return. And just the story, the way that the church approaches the Christ story, you know, where here's this baby, and then 4 months later, we're tacking the kid up. And then he's, you know, he's down, he's up again, and then he's going to be born in 8 months. It's really interesting. And you look at it slightly differently each time it comes around. It means something different to you every time around. And so that's kind of what I do.
So how did you get into writing for movies?
When I was 25, I auditioned to be the music director at a show called Beach Blanket Babylon, which is a very well-known in San Francisco, and it's kind of well-known the world over because it's the longest-running theatrical revue of its kind. I think it's like in its 38th year or something. It it started in the 70s in San Francisco, and it's a 90-minute kind of satire. Famously is, I forget who said it, but the satire closes on Saturday night is what some Broadway playwright, I think it was S.J. Perlman, said. But this has been running forever. It's sort of like, the British TV show, that was the week that was, or where there's songs and funny costumes that playfully skewer, I'm sounding like a PR blurb now, that they poke fun at happenings in pop culture and in the news and stuff. It's kind of, it's like pornography. It's hard to describe, but you know it when you see it. It's a very popular show. It incorporates dancers and singers in a band, and the show is constantly being rewritten based on what happens in the news. And a buddy of mine was the stage manager there, and I guess he got wind that they were looking for a music director because their current music director was going off to New York to do stuff on Broadway. And so I auditioned. I was selling keyboards part-time and working as a studio musician, producer, arranger kind of thing part-time. And also, of course, music directing at church. I'd been out of school, I guess, about 3 years. And I auditioned, and even though I was a little young, I got the gig. Mm-hmm. So I didn't move up to San Francisco immediately. I was living in Mountain View down the peninsula, like between San Jose and San Francisco. But I did end up moving there. Oh, actually, the way I ended up moving there is kind of funny. So anyhow, back to the movie stuff. I guess I had been at Beach Blanket for a couple of years. I was maybe 26, and I got a call from someone at the Beach Blanket office that Francis Ford Coppola was looking for a couple of people to sight read some music for him. I don't think there were any more details than that. So I said, yeah, I should be able to find the time for that. And so I met with him, and he had some music that had been written by his father and grandfather. His father was a composer and worked on many films with his son, and his father's father was a songwriter back in Italy, Francesco Panino. And so Francis had these tunes that he wanted me to just play through and record. And I did that, and we hit it off immediately. I guess he has a son my age, and my father is his age, and you know, we just kind of clicked a bit. He's a cool guy, and he mentioned as we were getting ready to go that he'd been playing with some tunes on his own. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And he said, Do you want to hear one? I'm like, of course. And so I said, do you mind if I record it? Maybe I can transcribe it for you. And oh, that'd be great. So I had a little recorder because, you know, be prepared. And it was a neat tune. And I took it home, and I did not sleep that night. What I did was I orchestrated the piece of music that he had sung to me and turned it into this, you know, theatrical thing. He had told me a bit about it, that it was a a scherzo, you know, a fast dance in triple meter that he envisioned for this musical about Pinocchio that he was interested in putting together. So I came back the next day, and, you know, it's one of those, you know, how I'm not sure I ever broke into the business, but if I did, you know, this is one of those stories in that, you know, I came back with a finished recording and they put me on the payroll so that I could continue to work, you know, with Francis and make music with him. And I continue to work with him to this day. I haven't scored a film from scratch for him because I've never had the profile for the powers that be, you know, to put the money behind something like that. But I've helped him out on practically every film he's worked on. When Apocalypse Now was redone as was when footage was added and it was re-released as Apocalypse Now Redux, I did the work on the new footage. That Apocalypse, the one thing that people never talk about with Apocalypse Now is the score, and it's all synthesized. It was electronically realized back before that was something that happened a lot.
Lots of Moogs and other things.
Yeah, Carmine. Yeah, exactly. Carmine Coppola's score, and then it was redone by a team of people with Moog synthesizers and stuff. And so I emulated that sound and went through the archives and found different pieces of score that Carmine had created for these scenes that later were cut before they had a chance for the music to be recorded. So I did that, and I've done other things for him and for his son, Roman. I've worked on some of Roman's films and commercials and stuff too. So, and I ended up renting a flat from him in San Francisco. they had a building near Beach Blanket at Babylon, and I had mentioned that I was looking to move up there. And he's like, oh, I might be able to help you out. And I lived there for 3 years. It was great.
Where do you usually work?
Now I work at home. After San Francisco, I met my wife. We got married. And she wasn't my wife when I first met her, of course. And then we moved out to Marin. And I guess we've been here 12 years. So I have a home studio. And, you know, home studio has increasingly become the way people do things, and I have a full rig here, and you know, I continue to produce songwriters and stuff and write music for various concerns. I'm increasingly involved in education, not because my professional opportunities have dried up at all, but because I dig it. It's cool. The more that I show things, the more the more I learn things, oddly enough. I'm sure that's your experience as well.
When you say you have a whole rig, what kind of equipment do you actually have?
When people ask, you're a musician, what instrument do you play? I'm like, well, you know, really? I play Macintosh. millions of people in my life would be in totally different if it weren't for Jobs and Wozniak and all those guys and the geniuses who have created the software and hardware that enable us to make music basically on a laptop. I don't use a laptop for making music, but you know, I basically have a large Macintosh system with a bunch of extra hardware cards so that it's the equivalent of a mixing desk and a rack, several racks of electronic signal processing equipment, and you know, probably 96 or 128 tracks of tape. You know, it's the equivalent of a very large commercial studio from the golden age of tape and, you know, wood paneling on the walls and that kind of thing.
Is all that done inside the computer?
It's mostly done outside, inside the computer. I do have external processing cards, DSP cards. I use a Pro Tools system, the Pro Tools HD, which is the top of the line system. The only way I've really been able to get into it is just by having it for years. I was the last generation to know how to calibrate an analog tape machine, and I've been fortunate in that first I could only control synthesizers with the computer, and then I could work on a two-channel mix. The computers were fast enough to deal with that. And then it went to 16 tracks and then unlimited. And oddly enough, in the last few years, I kind of felt like I wasn't physically involved in the music enough. So I got into old school analog synthesizers with patch cables and stuff like that. So I kind of collect those and use that stuff as well. It's the golden age for that. It's a new golden age for that stuff too, because there's a bunch of boutique manufacturers who have gotten a hold of the old schematics for those things. And so now there's all kinds of wonderful analog synthesizers available.
We'll have more with Ed, but first I want to remind you of the good work being done by the American Red Cross. If you ever need an operation, you'll be glad people donated blood to help you. So I want to remind you to give blood and to donate to the American Red Cross. They've been doing good for a long time. When my parents were prisoners of war, one of the things that saved their lives was a package they got from the Red Cross. Somewhere in the world today, there are people you can help through the Red Cross. And don't forget to get prepared yourself for emergency situations. Go to their store and check out the Personal Safety Emergency Pack. Do yourself a favor. Give to the American Red Cross. Go to redcross.org. Thanks. So, Ed, everyone needs self-motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
I'm always learning. I think that's the most important. When I look back on my brilliant career, I think then that's been the real thread where I'm always picking up some new piece of knowledge, whether it's a software program. I really started woodshedding on guitar about 6 years ago, concurrent, unfortunately, with my first call guitar player's early death in a car accident. And once, well, it's not something you get over, but once I, you know, went through the first stage of grief, I'm like, wow, I can't imagine bringing someone else in here. And I had always played a little guitar, but then I got really, I just worked really hard on it and got good enough to do the studio stuff that that other players, including my friend, had been doing. So, you know, it's stuff like that. When I got into analog synthesizers, I did that. I've learned stuff outside my immediate vocation. In my mid-20s, to get over my fear of flying, I got my private pilot's license, that kind of thing. When I got my iPad last year, I started dabbling in visual art. So I learned a little bit about perspective and drawing in the process of getting my head around Final Cut Pro and learning video editing. Hey, you know, it's really just like audio. You know, you've got plugins, you've got raw materials that you edit together and stuff like that. 'Cause I'm working on some multimedia musical education thing. So I'm always learning something. You know, my time will run out before my interests do.
Well, let me turn around the other way. How do you soothe yourself if you have to calm yourself down?
That's the hard one. you know, I don't know if you're familiar with a personality type analysis mumbo jumbo thing called the Enneagram. I know it's, you know, closely related to a bunch of other disciplines, and I don't really know that much about any of them, but a friend of mine is an Enneagram instructor, and he's really into it. And the thing that I know is that I am an Enneagram 7 to a T, like a, you know, a classic textbook. And what I understand about that is that I'm just into a lot of things. It's easier for me to be into a lot of things than it is to be into one thing. It's it's hard to tire me out. It's hard to slow me down. It's hard to pin me down. I'm easily distracted. I'm prone to addiction. I can be dazzlingly multi-talented. I can drive the people around me crazy. It's easy to get into debt. and just knowing that stuff has been really useful to try to get some self-awareness where what I do is concerned. And I'm fortunate that I have my gift, because I can kind of always go back to that a little bit. And I have an amazing wife and daughter, and that, you know, and a large, you know, group of friends and people that I make music with or hang out with and stuff. So I'm very, very fortunate in that regard. It keeps me as grounded as I'm ever going to be.
You mentioned addiction. That's not uncommon for musicians to encounter a variety of substances in their lives.
Oh, sure.
Something that you have had to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always dealing with it, you know. I mean, now I show up. I've always shown up. I, all things considered, I have an excellent work ethic, you know, and I overreact, to, you know, I'm overly sensitive to my tendencies, you know, to have two beers where one would be fine, or you know, something like that. But I've never gotten into any legal situation, never blew a gig, never blew out a lung, you know, and I've certainly seen other, I've had a fair number of friends die, musician friends, you know, through too much fun, or the after effects of too much fun. So it's, but it is something that I know that I, am prone to, but lately it's, you know, it's like, if I see it where, like, if I'm getting into Rachmaninoff, you know, where all of a sudden I've blown $50 on iTunes, you know, and, wasted an hour that I should have been doing something else, tracking down a score to the Opus 47 Symphonic Dances, which are absolutely kick-ass, by the way. So.
So it's more a matter of focusing intensely on things rather than going to rehab?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, it's part of what makes me who I am, though. The fact that I am this junkie for knowledge, and I'm good at retaining that stuff, it just makes me more useful to the general populace, because I have all this stuff and I'm good at tying the things in my brain together, you know, because that's sort of what a composer does. It's just little bits of things that you've heard from different places, and being fluent with that stuff and being able to spit it back out, and something that where the pieces that you've taken are so small and from such disparate sources that it appears that what you're doing is original.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Is there an event in my life that's challenged me to the core? Yeah. I've had some experience with diseases that I've overcome. Those have been challenging. I've had professional situations, film scores where there was a lot of work that had to be done very quickly, new experiences where I had to rise to the occasion, and there was very limited room for error. I was 26 or 27 when we did a Beach Blanket Babylon show at the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco, and we had a full orchestra at my disposal, and I had to rehearse everybody and write the score, write an hour and a half of music for the full orchestra and conduct it, and I had not done any of that stuff at that level or close to it. But I did it, you know, and unless these things are a total, like, front page disaster, you always come out of that stuff, you know, feeling like you're 100 feet tall. And when that shit wears off, you're like, oh, look, there are these cool things that I can do now. So it's good. I love those experiences. That's really important. Life would not be the same without them. Very fortunate doing what I'm doing that every day is a little different, especially considering my personality type, because if I just did one thing, I would go batshit.
If you were giving a commencement address, high school or college, what would be your best advice? What would you say?
Be a bunch of things. I mean, the best one, wear sunscreen, has already famously been taken, but definitely wear sunscreen. I would say show up. All that stuff is true, that it is who you know, and it is just being there and having some semblance of knowledge, that it's more important to try. You'd be, and especially things that you're not sure whether you can do, because you will surprise yourself. And what was I going to say? To do what you love, of course, but don't be an idiot about that. You know, try to find the cross section of where you're doing what you love, and you're also able to support yourself. That will work out. To not never erase this is different. You know, my generation, it was significant, the fact that I've always stayed in touch with people. That's always been real important to me. It just seemed like a good idea, and that's really paid off, both just being a well-rounded, happy human, and also from a work perspective. And I would always be learning, always be picking up new things, because that's really useful. And you'd be surprised that the more you learn, it's not going to knock other stuff out of your brain. It's just going to help reinforce the stuff that you do know.
The last question is to help me become better at this process.
Yeah.
Think of a defining moment in your life that we haven't talked about. What question should I have asked in order to get you to tell that story?
Well, a good question, if you can get a straight answer out of people, or even if you can't, is what would be your biggest regret?
So, Ed, what would be your greatest regret?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. First of all, first answer would be I cannot realistically say I have any, considering where I am and what I've achieved, what I have still to achieve, the general awesomeness, all things considered, of my well-fed middle-class musician life. I'm a well-fed middle-class musician, you know, with more work than I know what to do with. So, boom, there you go.
That's pretty rare.
You know, it's not as rare as you might think. I mean, I have a couple of buddies in my position where it's like we go to the office each morning and what we do is we make music. I have a friend who he just works with a cappella groups, just with singing groups all over the world. He won a Grammy a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, he goes to work at a computer like everybody else, and he's very happy. And there are lots of other people that I know, like in game music and stuff, and people who edit music tracks for film and TV or for pop producers and things like that. You know, I back to the commencement address, and then we'll get back to the regret. The commencement address is would be learn the technical side of whatever you do. You know, I'll go further, because an analogy that I use when I'm when people ask me, you know, oh, how do you do all this stuff, and I say that I approach it as if I approach what I do as if I was a doctor, as if you're constantly learning, constantly trying to be at the edge of your at the leading edge of your profession, knowing the best techniques so that you can kill as few people as possible. I mean, I use that phrase when I'm with mixing, when I'm mixing a record or editing. I say, first, do no harm. And not to say that what I do is as important as what doctors do, because honestly, considering how music affects people and makes them feel good, what I do is way more important than what doctors do. But I would say, get as much technical knowledge about what you do. Be able to do whatever you can do. The way they say that Steven Spielberg on a film set, if he had to fix a costume or if he had to be a grip and rig the electrics in an upcoming scene, he could do that. You know, if you're going to make music, know everything about it. If you're going to write books, know how they are physically printed. And even if that knowledge is soon to be irrelevant or temporarily irrelevant, just learn it all. You know, it's only going to make you better, and it's fun, too. My biggest regret, past the fact that I don't have them, I have big questions. I have roads not taken. I met a team of people who made who have gone on to be very famous and successful people who make records in my early 20s. And I could have dropped what I was doing. I was already, you know, making a decent living, producing independent records, selling keyboards. You know, I was about to go into the Beach Blanket Babylon thing. I often wonder what would have happened had I dropped that stuff and just kind of interned with these people and worked my way up the ladder with them. Whether it would have been, you know, whether I would have early learned about my problems with authority and being taught stuff, because I oddly enough, for an educator, I've been better learning on my own, and I have sort of, you know, it's part of my Enneagram 7 nature that I'm not great with authority figures. So who knows whether that would have happened, or whether I've gotten disillusioned with the music that those people were making, or whether I would have gone up the ladder and made some big records and, you know, been either, you know, comfortably semi-retired or dead on in a ditch at, you know, at 44, as opposed to where I am. And I also sometimes wonder, what would have happened if I had gone to an A-list university where you amass all these crazy contacts and things, and where, depending on your vocation, you have a free ride, but you have lots of opportunities, provided that you are good at what you do. You have this, you come out with this incredible Rolodex.
I hate to tell you this, but Berkeley is an A-list university.
Yes, it is, but it's not Stanford or Harvard, so it's not an A+.
Actually, may not be a networking one, which may be even more to the point. Some people are really good in their area, but there you don't have the social context that you're describing.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, all things considered, I've been fine. I mean, I'm kind of grasping, you know, for super regrets. I certainly don't regret being a musician. Something I didn't mention earlier is that I was interested in going into medicine because I was fascinated by that. And I was concerned about the ability to make a living as a musician. And my parents were, it was interesting because I guess my dad was pressured to go into law rather than to follow music. But my parents were like, be a musician. You're obviously good at it. You obviously love it. You should do that.
Very supportive.
Yeah. So it's all good. Do what you love.
I want to thank Ed Goldfarb for joining me today. Thanks, Ed. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.